Oui, bonjour. Good morning again, colleagues. Welcome to this regular press briefing here at the UN office at Geneva today, the 7th of July. Very important agenda for you today. We have Tommaso of the IFRC, who's going to introduce in a minute a colleague who's joining us from Kabul, who will speak to the situation of movement of Afghan returns from Iran. We also have colleagues who will join us shortly from the Human Rights Office on situation to speak to the situation on Kenya. And we have colleagues from the World Health Organization with a number of announcements. So without further ado, I'll turn over to Tommaso to introduce his colleague in Kabul.
Thank you very much, Rolando. Good morning, all. Today we have with us our IFRC Head of Delegation for Afghanistan, joining from Kabul, Sami Fakhouri. And he will speak about, as Rolando just said, an intensifying population movement crisis as Afghans return from Iran. He has just come back from the Islam Kala border, Herat province, and met many families crossing that border in 40 plus degrees heat with all their belongings. For any follow-up interviews, we can, of course, organize with Sami, or we have other several spokespeople in Afghanistan available for you. And we also have some strong AV material and human interest stories available for you in case you are interested. Thank you. Sami.
Yep, Sami.
Thank you, colleagues. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's press briefing on the situation of the returnees from Iran in Afghanistan. So as Tommaso mentioned last week with colleagues, we visited the province of Herat, the north eastern province, and we went to the border area with Iran. What we saw at the Islam Kala border crossing was really heartbreaking. We saw bus after bus arriving, loaded with people, arriving to a border where the temperature is 40 plus, sun hitting very strong, people exhausted. Those same people, families, one day or 2 days before, they were sitting in their home in Iran, leading a relatively normal life. And next thing they knew, they were on a bus heading for the border and then asked to get off at the border. They're returning to the country that they left many years before. In terms of numbers, just in June alone, over 135,000 people returned to Afghanistan from Iran. And since the beginning of the current year, the number now is over 1 million, according to the latest figure from UNHCR. And for our member, the Afghan Red Crescent, they are anticipating that an additional 1 million people, possibly more, maybe may return from Iran to Afghanistan by the end of this year. While being there and walking around among the returning people who were basically sitting on the ground, one conversation is still fresh in my mind. I spoke with colleagues with a woman sitting on top of her two, three suitcases with her children under the sun. She was waiting for her husband who went to collect some food from an Afghan Red Crescent point that was distributing food nearby. Basically, she was dazed. That's my impression of her. But then she told us that she's coming to a country that she left young, that she doesn't know very much. She's coming to a country where she doesn't have a home. In her case, and luckily for her and her family, she has family in a province close to Kabul, and they offered to lodge her and her family. Unfortunately, that is not the case for many of the people returning. They don't know where they're going to go, where they will be lodged. So that story of this woman and her family is really just one from hundreds of thousands of families and people. The common thing that all these stories have is how difficult it is to leave everything behind, leave your life from one day to another, and start over without notice in a new country. And especially this for parents. The parents are worried about the education and safety of their children, especially their daughters. So a very, very dire picture. For us at the IFRC, we believe that returns should always be done voluntarily and that people should be treated with the utmost respect and dignity. After visiting the border area, I especially want to acknowledge the incredible work of the Afghan Red Crescent. Their staff and volunteers have been distributing daily 6,000 hot meals to those people. They've been providing primary healthcare, medical services to the people returning, including psychosocial support. They're providing temporary shelter and water. But when you see the number of people arriving, which peaked at over 30,000 in one day, you realize that even all what they're doing is not enough. For food, this means less than one meal per person. We are doing our best with the resources we currently have, but the truth is we don't have enough resources as a humanitarian actor on the ground to cover even the average amount of people who cross into Afghanistan daily. And more worrying is the continuation of services we need to provide in the medium and long term to help those Afghan people returning to rebuild their lives and establish a livelihood. It is a stark reminder. We are providing help, but the needs are much, much higher, so we are falling short. All this comes on top of more than 1 million people who have already returned from Pakistan, in a country where half of the population relies on some level of humanitarian assistance. And underneath all of the visible crises, there's another one that's harder to see. Hopelessness, depression, and a deep sense of desperation present in this country. It comes from a broken health system, massive unemployment, the freezing of Afghan assets, and limitations on girls' education. The people in this country, a lot of them young and old, are stuck at home all day with no real sense of purpose after decades of conflict and trauma and natural disaster after natural disaster. It just keeps building. Quickly, this weekend in the province of Nangarhar, it is next to the Pakistan border, it was hit by extreme floods. Many returnees from Pakistan who were trying to rebuild their lives are now losing their homes again. Over 250 homes have been destroyed, and none or very few media outlets outside of Afghanistan has carried this news or mentioned it. And sadly, the flooding is expected to continue. We all know and appreciate that there are so many global emergencies going on simultaneously in the world. But we cannot forget that these extremely high numbers represent people. People with different stories, children who deserve a chance to live a life they are dreaming of, and that if they even get the chance to dream. Therefore, action is needed now so Afghanistan doesn't fall into a deeper crisis that would be impossible to come out from. The IFRC is appealing for 25 million francs, Swiss francs, to support the Afghan Red Crescent's operations at the border crossings, at transit camps, and at final places where these Afghan returnees will settle. At the moment, and very sadly, our appeal is only 10% funded. What this may mean is that we will need to further scale down our support if we do not get the right resources, and Afghan Red Crescent will need to make hard choices on whom they can continue supporting or not. The Afghan people are in urgent need of continued support, not just today, but for the month and years ahead. The IFRC is committed to sustain Afghan Red Crescent safe shelters for women and their children. These centers offer trainings that empower women to rebuild their lives. In closing, to tackle the many challenges Afghanistan faces, swift and coordinated action is essential. And that can only happen if there is greater awareness, media visibility, and increased funding. I thank you for listening, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sami. Very important messages indeed. So before we take questions, I just want to throw quickly to Babar of the Refugee Agency. I think you wanted to add a note on the numbers. So Babar, if...
Good morning, dears. Thank you very much, and huge thanks, Sami, for updating from your trip on the border. Just to complement what you were saying and the updated numbers that we have received from colleagues. Just a second. So in general, as you were speaking, total returns from Iran since 1st of January this year have exceeded, as you mentioned, 1 million. The exact figure is more than 1.2 million. We saw on Friday when our colleague Arfaz Jamal was briefing, that was the day that we saw the highest number in one day, and that figure was more than 50,000 that were arriving. And as was being mentioned, Islam Kala and Dauran are the border point where majority of Afghans are coming back into Afghanistan, and that figure is 77% of Afghans are using that border point to enter. Further in the south, we also have Zaranj. That number is at 22%, but as it was mentioned, a huge number of Afghans from Iran are being deported, and that number is more than 635,000 so far this year. And majority, as we have been talking, the Afghan arrivals have picked up since June this year, and we have seen more than 600,000 that have arrived from 1st of June till now. And still, colleagues at the borders are seeing big numbers that are arriving, and mostly, as it was mentioned, are families with children also, and many of them have never set foot on the Afghan soil before being uprooted from Iran. That's it. Back to you, Rolando.
Thanks very much for that additional context, Babar, and appreciate if you could share those notes. Lots of numbers there are important. So we'll take the questions, and thank you once again, Sami. We have a question from Anadolu of Turkish News Agency. Beyza.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning. Beyza Dönmez from Anadolu. Thank you, Sami, for this briefing. I just wanted to ask, you said that there is not enough resources. So does that mean under the current conditions, sustainable reintegration of the returnees is not possible? And also, do you think that host countries should stop the voluntary or forcible returns immediately? And my second question is, what are the protection risks being observed among returnees, especially about women, children, or unaccompanied minors, and how these are being responded? Thank you.
Thank you, Beyza. Sami?
Thank you for the question. Thank you for the question. The reintegration of the people returning, that is really where we have unclarity, let's say, in terms of support, because the authorities have a plan, but the resources also are limited. at the authority side, they are preparing some areas, towns to receive some of those families. But when you're looking at, you know, 70 or 1,000 person crossing per day, as Babar mentioned very recently last week, it is a tremendous effort, and a lot of resources are needed to reintegrate all those people also in the economy, in normal life, so they have livelihoods. It is not easy. It's a country with high unemployment. These people left a lot of them because to look for economic opportunities elsewhere, and they have, some of them had jobs in Iran or in Pakistan, and now they're coming back to some of them a country they left because they didn't find a job, and they might have to leave again, some of them. In terms of protection, I mean, we see young people coming back alone. We see women with their children coming. They're being received as best they can. In terms from the Afghan Red Crescent side, we are trying to provide shelter for those we can, but we have very limited capacities. We have psychosocial support mechanism at the border, but also with limited capacity. We're trying to scale up, but at the same time, our resources are very limited.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sami. Babar, if you have anything to add, of course, do chime in, maybe on the protection issue, but no. Okay, for the moment, it will.
Sure. Rolando, just to add to what was being said, also many arrivals are mentioning family separations at the border as well, as some of them have been either left inside Iran or others that also have arrived or gone to other places inside Afghanistan. That's a big worry as well. And also those who are returning, they talk about detention. They talk also about harassment. And also, as it has been mentioned, Afghans in majority inside Iran live in the cities. So it's a very, the profile of this population is very urban. And that's why we are seeing that majorities who move away are either going to Kabul or in Herat, as these are two major urban centers. And many of them, as being mentioned, have not seen Afghanistan before. They have been born as refugees in exile. And as mentioned, resources are a big worry. Moving on from here, what's going to happen to this population? This is a big question that Afghans have in their mind who are returning, but also the situation at the border point, as we saw on July the 4th, 50,000 returning in just one day is very, very chaotic for us as humanitarians, as was being mentioned, but also for all those Afghans who are being uprooted and have to arrive into Afghanistan in this way. Thank you.
Thank you again, Babar and Tasami. We have questions in the room, starting maybe, I think, Emma had her hand up first, so going to Emma of Reuters.
Thanks. I was wondering if the gentleman from the IFRC could give us some of the ideas, an idea of some of the stories. Are people specifically saying they've been forced back, and what are they telling you about that? And secondly, on humanitarian planning, presumably you hadn't factored in having this many people coming back to Afghanistan in such a short period of time. Does that raise concerns about a very severe hunger in the months ahead? And how are you planning for that? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I mean, the people we spoke to, the majority, they didn't have a say in coming back. So they came back to Afghanistan, they were put on buses, and they were driven to the border. That's the sad reality. Or the funding, and the second part of the question, you know, potential hunger crisis. So right now, funding for Afghanistan in general is low. It's been not a good year for the UN system, for the Red Cross system. It's been quite limited funding. The authorities, of course, the economy is not doing well. They have limited capacities. What will this mean? It will mean more suffering. It will mean definitely already before the returnees crisis, there was concerns of famines, of hunger. And I think the UN system had a few reports on that. But now when you add in, when you factor in millions of returnees, definitely that will only increase in severity.
Thank you very much, Sami. We will take a question now from Nina of AFP.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to ask about, you talked about family separations at the border. Do you have any estimate or have you seen sort of the how big a problem it is with children having being separated from their parents, being unaccompanied, and what kind of measures are in place to help them? Is there, and also when it comes to psychosocial support, could you sort of say what kind of things you're seeing there? I assume maybe there would be a lot among girls especially, but maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe I can start, and then Babar, if you want to complement, please. So the returning people were for the children. They are, some of them, you see a lot of young males as well returning. So they have been working in Iran, living in Iran, and they are returning to Afghanistan. In terms of psychosocial support, I mean, you see all the people, they have mental scars from this experience of returning to Afghanistan. You know, you have to we have to put ourselves in their shoes. So basically, I am an Afghani. I left Afghanistan for a better life, for a job, for a better future. I got a job, and now I've been sent back to Afghanistan, and the situation is probably worse than when I left. And now I have to start from scratch, or maybe look at leaving again, you know, maybe to another country, because I might not find anything in Afghanistan. So it's quite difficult for all those people. I think also a lot of them, you see them at the border, they haven't computed all the problem that they have, because it's very fresh. You know, 2 days ago they were in Iran, now they are on the border, and they don't even know what's gonna happen later today or tomorrow. So even, you know, it didn't sit in for them, those people.
Thank you so much. Babar, if you wanted to jump in, just raise your hand or just let
sure.
us know.
Thank you, Orlando. Just to add to what Sami was saying, indeed, the psychological scars are going to stay with Afghans who have been made to come back to their country in this way. Deportations or pressure applied anywhere in the region or beyond, it's going to affect them, and it's going to affect many really badly. What we have been hearing, and what my colleagues at UNHCR and with other humanitarian partners that we have been documenting, family separation is a big issue and a concern for returning Afghans. The figures I have in front of me is 41% of returnees that we spoke to and we were talking to they were mentioning family separation. So they are worried. We don't have a count in terms of how many Afghan children are coming back unaccompanied, but it is a worry. Even people who have earlier come inside Afghanistan or those who have been left behind in Iran, it is a big worry for all those Afghans who are coming back. And also, as mentioned, I mean, the future of their children will also be a big worry, as this is another humanitarian crisis on top of an existing one. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll take any additional questions in the room or online. Yes, we do have a question online from Isabel of FA, Spanish News Agency. Isabel.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for this information, this briefing. I've not been following closely this issue, so I allow me to ask maybe things that you are already known. But what are the reasons given by the Iranian government to expel Afghan people? This is one. Secondly, do you have any breakdown of the Afghan people in Iran that have a regular migratory status? Because I understand that this at least in the officially is targeting people that has no regular status. So how many of them, or what is the ratio of people having regular or and not regular status in migratory status in Iran? And also, do you have any channel of communication with the Iranian government to convey them your concerns, and what are their obligations in terms of international humanitarian law? And the same with the authorities of Afghanistan. What is the cooperation or communication that you have with them? Thank you.
Sami, and once again, Babar, if you have anything to add, please jump in. But Sami, over to you first.
Thank you. I think on the numbers and more information breakdown, probably Babar is better placed for that. But what I can say is that the statistics, I think, is between 3 and 4 million Afghan peoples in Iran. So a lot of them have irregular status, and some of them has some form of identification or residency or refugee status. So I think Babar will have more information on that. The reason that the countries or Iran is saying for returning those people, I think many reasons. The economy in Afghanistan, in Iran, is suffering, so they also want to keep a job for their people. This is, you know, increased competition. Recently, also, some of you maybe read in the news also, after the conflict with Israel, there's been a lot of talk of people sending information to Israel and others. So that was another reason why they increased also getting some of the Afghan people back to Afghanistan.
Thank you very much, Sami. Babar?
Thank you, Sami. Thank you, Rolando. Indeed, the numbers in terms of the refugee population in Iran is world's largest refugee host. And they have been a generous host, not only for Afghans, but many other refugee populations. And Afghans have been in Iran for over 40 years since the Soviet invasion and many cycles of displacement that Afghans have seen, and they're very thankful for that role that Iran has played. This episode is not new. On March 20th this year, Iran announced that undocumented Afghans, or they wanted a portion of Afghan population to leave and also come through a regular way. My understanding is they've been asked, you go, and then you can apply. But in this mix, we've seen there are many, many Afghans who are caught up in these movements, and no one was imagining a movement of this scale happening. As we keep giving you the numbers, which are really big numbers. I mean, if we talk from the beginning of this year, 1.2 million that have returned from Iran. Not only that, as mentioned, there are a big number of Afghans who have been coming back from Pakistan as well, which is also has traditionally been a very kind and generous host for them. As we are seeing at the borders inside Afghanistan, the number is in tens of thousands. That's why the latest movement we saw was of 50,000 people who arrived on 4th of July on Friday, last Friday, and the number, it does not seem that it is slowing down. In terms of our appeals, you have heard, I think we have been coming to this forum to raise our concerns, but also in terms of repeating our calls for a voluntary gradual return of Afghans, because the situation in Afghanistan is already dire, and we cannot afford to see Afghans returning in this big numbers. Back to you,
Lund. Well noted. Thank you very much, Babar. Okay, so I'm going to check to see if we have further questions for either of you, either in the room, online. I don't see that's the case. So once again, maybe I don't know if Tommaso had anything to add or no. I'd like to thank you very much, Sami, for joining us. Keep up the immensely important work, and thank you again for joining us here, and to you, Babar, for adding a very important context to the situation in Afghanistan and, of course, in the neighboring Iran. So thank you. Ravina of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is making her way up to the podium, and she is going to, we're going to switch to the situation in Kenya, where she'll address the situation of the protests, which are going on in Kenya. So thank you very much for joining us here, Ravina. Over to you.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. On Kenya, we are deeply troubled by the killings yesterday of at least 10 people, as well as looting and destruction of property in Kenya as police and other security forces responded to violent protests in the capital of Nairobi and at least 16 other counties. Lethal ammunition, rubber bullets, tear gas, and water cannons were used. Police have reported that at least 11 people were killed, 52 police officers injured, and that 567 arrests were made. The Kenyan National Commission on Human Rights has reported at least 10 fatalities, 29 injuries, 37 arrests, and 2 abductions. We've also received reports of looting and damage to public and private property by unidentified individuals in multiple locations. It is very concerning that these latest incidents come barely 2 weeks after more than 15 protesters were reportedly killed and many more injured in Nairobi and in other parts of Kenya on the 25th of June. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, renews his call for calm and restraint and full respect for the freedoms of expression, association, and peaceful assembly. It is essential that legitimate grievances at the root of these protests are addressed. We note that the police have announced an investigation into earlier incidents. The High Commissioner repeats his call for all reported killings and other alleged violations and abuses of international human rights law, including with respect to the use of force, to be promptly, thoroughly, independently, and transparently investigated. Those responsible must be held to account. Under international human rights law, intentional lethal force by law enforcement officers, including the use of firearms, should only be used when strictly necessary to protect life. Our office stands ready to support the authorities in Kenya in addressing these challenges, including in the investigations.
Thank you very much, Ravina, for this important update. Colleagues, I go over to you for questions. Room. Online, give it a second. Okay. No, well, yeah, you want, okay, let's just make sure there's no questions on Kenya. Yeah, I think maybe on that case, I think it was very comprehensive, very, very clear. So thank you very much. If it's okay, we'll entertain another question before we take our announcements, since Ravina, since you're on the podium. So Emma Reuters.
Hi, good morning, Ravina. It's a question on Israel and Gaza, please, and displacement. There's reports that Netanyahu is working with other countries, along with the United States, to offer to residents of Gaza a better future by moving to other nations. I'm just wondering what your reaction to this is. Is there any way that this could be an acceptable outcome? And if so, what would those conditions need to be? Thank you.
The short answer, Emma, is no. We have seen these reports, which raise several concerns regarding forcible transfer, possible arrests of young people and men in relation to possible, in addition to possible killings due to the kind of force that we have seen in recent days. Large numbers of people would be confined to even smaller spaces with movement restrictions. So no, this is certainly not acceptable.
Sorry, just to clarify, I think you were talking about within Gaza. So this idea is actually to work with other nations to potentially assist with so-called voluntary movements of Palestinians outside of Gaza. Could that be acceptable in any way? Thank you.
Right. No, thank you. Sorry about that, Emma. Again, this raises concerns with regards to forcible transfer. The concept of voluntary transfers in the context that we are seeing in Gaza right now is very questionable.
Thank you very much, Ravina. Do we have further questions for Ravina before we release her? No, that's not the case. So thank you again, as always, Ravina, for joining us here. Colleagues, WHO, Christian and Shagun, please join us here. And I think Catherine, you also wanted to, if you want to jump up here as well, Catherine, Catherine of UNCTAD also had an announcement, so in addition to the agenda. But you well know Christian, of course, of WHO. There's a new colleague, Shagun Kare, who is joining us for the first time. She's a media colleague, hence the nameplate, so that you know who you're speaking with. But we have some announcements, starting maybe with you first, Christian. Over to you.
Thank you, Rolando, and thanks also for introducing our colleague. As Rolando just said, new colleague in the media department currently, so happy to have her first time here with us today. Two quick announcements from my side. Tomorrow, while the heat is giving us a bit of a break right now, we don't think this might be the last time. Then, hence, there's a webinar scheduled for tomorrow, not because of the heat wave that was anyway planned. It's called Managing the Heat, Strengthening Public Health Preparedness for Mass Gatherings in a Warming World. Should be really interesting. It's from 1 o'clock to 2:15 tomorrow as a webinar. It's an online opportunity. The link has been sent. If not, otherwise, we'll can share that again. Another really interesting start seeing tomorrow, the first meeting of the International Intergovernmental Working Group on the WHO Pandemic Agreement. You recall that in May 2025, the World Health Assembly adopted the Pandemic Agreement under the article of the Constitution of the World Health Organization to strengthen pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. And through this resolution, the Health Assembly established an open-ended intergovernmental working group to undertake several tasks. And let me just remind you of some of those tasks. These include, as a priority, drafting and negotiating an annex to the pandemic agreement on the pathogen access and benefit sharing system to enable safe, transparent, and accountable access and benefit sharing for materials and sequence information. The Assembly decided in May that the outcome of this work should be submitted to the 79th World Health Assembly in 2026 for its consideration. So they have nearly one year to go, and tomorrow is the first meeting. As per habit, the opening sequences and the closing sequences would be live streamed. Opening is on Wednesday, tomorrow, and closing then on Thursday. Thank you from me, and over to Segun.
Thank you, Christian. Thank you for this opportunity. We would like to ensure that you know how to follow us on updates around the avian influenza outbreak that's affecting Cambodia. We published a disease outbreak news that was shared with the press on Saturday, but since it's an evolving situation, we already have updates to that. This year, Cambodia has reported 12 laboratory-confirmed human cases of avian influenza or bird flu H5N1 to WHO. When we sent out the disease outbreak news on Saturday, that figure was 11, so there was one new case reported yesterday. Eight out of these 12 cases were reported since the start of June, so it has been quite an intensification of the numbers recently. Based on the available information, all of these cases were exposed to sick poultry or to contaminated environments. WHO continues to assess the risk to the general public to be low, and the risk for those who might be exposed at their workplace, such as farm workers, we assess the risk to be low to moderate. WHO is supporting the country of Cambodia in responding to this outbreak, but I'd also like to mention a few other things that we do and some related resources to that. So we routinely monitor the risk that these viruses pose. We publish monthly risk assessments. We'll share the links to those in an email that's just gone out to you. But one of the other things that we do is assess the pandemic risk of these viruses. That's a separate ongoing work. Along with the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Organization for Animal Health, we do carry out some joint work, and there is an assessment that is being updated as we speak. So the disease outbreak news that went out on Saturday and these assessments, you'll have the links to those in your email. And then if there is interest in this topic, we'd be happy to organize interviews with the experts. Thank you.
Thank you, Segun, and Christian as well. Are there any questions for our colleagues, WHO? I think it was very, very clear. No, okay, so no, thank you again and welcome. And of course, we'll share your contacts with our media, our press corps here. So thanks again, and thanks to you, Christian. Catherine, over to you then.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the floor at the very last minute. Just to announce you that we are going to publish the July global trade update with all the global figures, facts and figures about the global trade, which endures policy changes and geoeconomic risk. There's nothing new in this announcement, but we have details for the first quarter, the nowcast for the second quarter of 2025. Global trade continue to expand, led by imports in the US and exports from European Union. You'll have all the details in the document. It's a short one. And the second part, so it's national with the main economies, the regional trends, and the imbalances in the market, in global markets. And the second part of this global trade updates will it's called the Policy Insights, will focus on a highly concentrated digital markets and the risk on competition and the consumers that are, of course, at risk too in this highly concentrated market. We have this week, it's been announced in the list of events, the ninth UN conference on the exact title is on competition and consumer protection. So it's been held in the room 19, and they are reviewing all the UN principles in these fields and how to implement them in the in the different countries. It will celebrate the 45th anniversary of the adoption of the UN set of principles and rules on competition and the 40th anniversary of the adoption of the UN guidelines on for consumer protection. So it's a very important conference. And this is the occasion in this global trade update to highlight what's happening in this in the digital in digital markets, sorry, globally. Thank you. That's it. It will be issued today or tomorrow morning at the latest.
Merci beaucoup, Catherine. Thank you so very much for that. Any questions for Catherine? No, I don't see it. Okay, so thanks once again. Merci beaucoup. Okay, colleagues, just a few announcements from me to keep you on track. As you know, Secretary General Antonio Guterres wrapped up a short trip to Rio de Janeiro, where he attended the BRICS summit. We sent to you a couple of statements that he delivered at important meetings. Firstly, dealing with artificial intelligence. In his statement, he emphasized that AI cannot be a club of the few, but must benefit all, and in particular, developing countries, which must have a real voice in governance of artificial intelligence, end quote. So that was a statement that he delivered on, in fact, on Sunday. Then yesterday, Monday, he addressed a crowd on the issue of the environment and global health. And he warned that our environment is being attacked on all fronts. He also held a number of bilateral meetings, in particular with the foreign minister of Turkey and foreign minister of Iran. We shared those readouts with you. And then we had a statement, of course, on the horrific situation in Texas with the floods. So I just wanted to make sure you saw that statement, which we shared with you yesterday in the afternoon. And we note in the media that sadly, the civilian loss of life, the numbers are going up. So horrific situation in Texas. Wanted to give you a heads up. Later this afternoon, we'll share with you a statement from the Secretary General on to mark the 30th anniversary of the atrocity in Srebrenica. Of course, many of you remember this. It was actually July 1995 when this massacre, this atrocity unfolded. There's a Secretary General statement that he will deliver this afternoon at 11 a.m. New York time, so that's 5 p.m. our time. We'll make sure to share that important statement with you. And then last couple of notes, the Human Rights Committee this morning is concluding its review of Vietnam. And this Thursday morning, there will be a public meeting with states parties and the Human Rights Council. Of course, you're following closely the proceedings there. They're scheduled to wrap up their 59th session tomorrow after having adopted all the resolutions. I don't know exactly where they are right now in the program, but I'm sure you're looking at the updates from Pascal. They have quite a number of resolutions pending. And then I should also mention that the Conference on Disarmament will officially begin the third and last part of its 2025 session on the 28th of July. And this is under the presidency of Malaysia. And beyond that, as you well know, the AI for Good conference kicks off this morning at Palexpo. We had the WISIS yesterday and today, the AI for Good conference. You have all the information. Our colleague David was here last week to brief you on that. So I will not go further, but obviously important gathering just up the road. That's it for me. Any questions? No. On that note, I wish you a good afternoon and see you here on Friday.